This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening to this, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This holiday season, treat yourself. Treat yourself to candy. Celebrate the holiday season with the Holiday Crush. They've sprinkled candy with a holiday theme and fun-packed challenges every week for 5 whole weeks, finishing on January 4th. The more challenges you complete, the better your chances of unwrapping delicious rewards. So, are you ready to crush the holidays? Play the Holiday Crush now. Download it from the App Store, Google Play, or Windows Store for free. Terms and conditions apply.
In February of 1431, one of the most famous trials in medieval European history got underway. The defendant was none other than the 19-year-old Joan of Arc. The crime that she was accused of was nothing less than heresy. Over 16 sessions of grueling examinations, the latter half of which would be carried out in Joan's prison cell, the church officials set out to prove that this young girl had willfully perverted the teachings of the Catholic Church. Her trial wasn't just meant to prove that she was a witch or a purveyor of black magic. Instead, it was meant to show that this girl was leading Christians away from the true path of the Catholic faith. Her campaign, that she had claimed was commanded by God himself and communicated through his angels, was to her inquisitors a dark twisting of Catholic doctrine. We all know that God doesn't talk to peasant girls, and if he was to, he certainly wouldn't tell them to dress in drag and lead an army. To these men, her quest seemed completely inconsistent with their interpretation of the faith, and in this way, she was worse than a witch. She was a heretic. If you were found guilty of witchcraft, you were usually hung. Heresy, on the other hand, well, that called for a burning. But despite the fact that Joan was in mortal peril, she remained lucid and often defiant throughout most of her grueling trial. Take, for instance, the fact that Joan wouldn't even swear an oath at the outset of the trial to always tell the truth. The trial record reads, quote, "Questioner, do you swear to speak the truth in answer to such questions as are put to you?" Joan: "I do not know what you wish to examine me on. Perhaps you might ask such things that I would not tell." Questioner: "Will you swear to speak the truth upon those things which are asked you concerning the faith which you know?" Joan: "Concerning my father and my mother, and what I have done since I took the road to France, I will gladly swear to tell the truth. But concerning my revelations from God, these I have never told or revealed to anyone, save only to Charles, my king, and I will not reveal them to save my head." End quote. I think that one deserves an aw snap. It takes someone with an incredible amount of courage and a real sense of personal righteousness to basically say that they would rather die than play by the rules of someone else's kangaroo court. But perhaps there's an explanation. Perhaps Joan wasn't just brave. She might have just been crazy. Indeed, since Joan of Arc's death in 1431, there has been no shortage of speculation about Joan's state of mind. True believers would continue to advocate for the legitimacy of Joan's divine visions, and they would be incredibly successful. In 1456, Joan's conviction for heresy would be posthumously overturned by a second church tribunal. The Catholic Church would then double down on their appraisal of the veracity of Joan's visions by canonizing her as a saint in 1920. The Church's final take on Joan seems to be that she was exactly as she presented herself, a devout Christian who had been blessed with direct orders from God himself. But for many others, this explanation continues to feel unsatisfying. Since the time of her death, Joan of Arc has been a puzzle that has attracted a boatload of conspiracy theorists, armchair psychologists, and, as the great Sarah Vowell once said, historian-adjacent wise guys such as yours truly. Was there more to Joan of Arc than the historical record lets on? Was she truly a divinely inspired peasant girl, or was she actually the well-bred pawn in an aristocratic scheme to prop up the House of Valois? Was Joan of Arc even in her right mind? Could the savior of France actually have been suffering from a mental illness that gave her wild delusions of grandeur? And what of that crazy story that Joan of Arc managed to escape her own execution and live happily ever after? Was France's greatest martyr even actually martyred? All that and more on today's Our Fake History. Episode 23, How Do You Explain Joan of Arc? Part 3. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major and this is the show where we look at historical myths and try and figure out what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. Today we are concluding our three-part series on Joan of Arc. So if you haven't heard the first two parts of the series, you may want to go back and give those a listen now. Honestly, guys, this series kind of got away from me a little bit. I originally envisioned this exploration of Joan of Arc as a two-parter, but the deeper I got into this story, the weirder it became. Joan's life was so short, but it was also so full of incident that it seemed wrong just to breeze through it. Around every corner, there seemed to be another miracle or a truly impossible story that needed to be unpacked. But at long last, today we will finally get to the stuff that I have been teasing for the past two episodes. All the weird psychological speculation, after-the-fact mythology, and straight-up conspiracy theories that seek to explain a figure that seems to stubbornly resist explanation. Now, when we last left Joan, her military career had been abruptly brought to an end after she was pulled from her horse by an archer named Lionel. Her Burgundian captors then proceeded to sell Joan of Arc to the English for the handsome price of 10,000 livres, which in today's reckoning is, I don't know, a butt ton of money. She was then transferred to the city of Rouen, the English administrative capital in France at the time, where she was imprisoned for the duration of her trial. The court that would try Joan of Arc was headed by the bishop Pierre Cochon, who would make Joan undergo hours of repetitive and circular questioning designed specifically to trap her into making heretical statements. But one of the amazing things about Joan is that she rarely takes the bait. Also, side note about Cochon, his name sounds almost exactly like the French word for pig, which is cochon. So I kind of took some weird personal delight in imagining Joan being questioned by a dude named Pierre the Pig. Man, but I digress. Now, as I've mentioned before, these trial records are a truly incredible primary source, as they actually capture Joan's voice. This is perhaps why so many people have been so comfortable speculating about Joan's mental health. We know how she spoke, we know how she answered questions, and we can even glean bits of her personality. One of the most striking things about her is her obvious intelligence. She knows that she's being set up, and she very cannily avoids logic traps that have been sprung by Cauchon and the other questioners. I'll give you an example. A big part of Catholic theology is the idea that no mortal person can know the mind of God. God chooses who he will bestow mercy upon and admit into heaven. This is commonly called being, quote, in God's grace. It was considered heretical if you claimed to know who was in heaven and who was not. The idea here is that God is mysterious, he lets in whoever he deems fit, so making claims about who is and who isn't in heaven, it's kind of a serious sin. Interestingly enough, in the Catholic religion, the only people you can safely assume are in heaven are the canonized saints. So, the next time you say, I'm pretty sure my grandma's in heaven, you're committing a sin there, buddy. And even then, the church fathers are very careful not to get too haughty about knowing the mind of God. The saints are just their best guesses. So with that in mind, the questioners lob this little question at Joan. Quote, questioner, do you know whether or not you are in God's grace? Now, here's the thing. If Joan says yes, then she is committing blasphemy because she is claiming to be a saint. But if she says no, then she is still claiming to know the mind of God, which is still heretical. But check out this very clever response on the part of Joan. She says, quote, if I am not, may God put me there. And if I am, may God so keep me. I should be the saddest creature in the world if I knew I were not in his grace. End quote. Her response was so good that one notary tells us that it, quote, stupefied the court. Cauchon was apparently visibly annoyed by Joan's clever answer. What's interesting is that the transcript is full of moments like this. The questioners try to make her misspeak or ensnare her with obscure theology, and she always manages to nimbly dance around their traps. But despite Joan's impressive fortitude in the trials, the inquisitors were eventually able to wear her down. Once the interrogations were moved from a more public gallery and into Joan's cell, her resolve steadily started to diminish. At one point, she even made an apparent suicide attempt, jumping from the window of her tower. She survived after landing in a luckily soft and muddy patch of land. But all that meant was that now she needed to answer for this in front of her questioners. Ultimately, Joan was undone by a trick played on her by her prison guards. She had agreed to stop wearing men's clothing in a bargain so that she might be able to hear Mass and take communion with a priest. Joan, however, would later claim that the dress that they gave her to wear put her in greater danger of being sexually assaulted by her guards. When she was offered men's clothing again, she was quick to put them on. Now, this seemingly meaningless little act was all the court needed. Her choice to put men's clothing back on could be used as evidence that she was a relapsed heretic. You see, you were only allowed to execute a heretic if, after they had sworn off their heresy, they relapsed. When Joan originally agreed to no longer wear men's clothing, they were able to interpret that as, well, she has sworn off her heresy. But when she put those clothes back on, that meant that she had once again chosen to follow a backwards version of the faith. It was a pretty flimsy pretense, but that's all they needed. And so, on May 28th, 1431, Joan of Arc was burned at the stake in the Old Market in Rouen. Now, there are dozens of weird apocryphal stories that have to do with Joan's execution. The most common story, apparently attested to later by an eyewitness, says that an English soldier slipped Joan a small wooden cross to hold while she was burning for comfort. We're also told that someone in the crowd held up a cross at Joan's eye level so she could look upon it and be comforted. And those stories seem entirely plausible. Some crazier stories tell us that after Joan of Arc's body burned away, her heart remained completely unburnt by the flames. The story goes that an English soldier sliced at the bizarrely unburnt heart with his sword, but when he cut the heart in half, a single white dove emerged from the organ and flew away into the sky. Now that one almost certainly did not happen. But the most enduring conspiracy theory about Joan of Arc's execution was that the person burnt at the stake wasn't Joan of Arc at all. For a long time, there has been a tradition that Joan escaped her execution and an unlucky surrogate was swapped in and burned in her place. The, quote, real Joan of Arc was then spirited away and actually lived a long and healthy life as the wife of a nobleman in northern France. Now, this story has had some serious legs. It was even revived as lately as 2007 in a book by the French writers Marcel Gay and Roger Senzig. And, interestingly enough, this theory isn't completely without a historical basis. You see, after the death of Joan of Arc in 1431, there were a number of young women who started touring France claiming to be the real Joan. Most of these Joan imposters were not very successful in their deceptions. Apparently, in 1457, a woman named Jeanne de Sormet spent 3 months in prison for masquerading as Joan of Arc. Nevertheless, there are still researchers who believe that perhaps one of these women may have actually been the genuine article. The Joan imposter who tends to get the most attention is a woman by the name of Claude d'Armois. She first appears in the historical record in 1436 in the town of Metz. There, we are told that she was going around presenting herself using two names. Sometimes she would present herself as Claude, and other times she would present herself as Jean La Pucelle, a.k.a. Joan of Arc. Now, what's interesting about this case is that the Chronicle of Metz tells us that she looked almost exactly like the real Joan. So much so that a local noble, Nicole Louvet, who had actually seen Joan in person at the coronation of Charles VII, believed that it was her, and even sent her a white horse as a gift. Even more incredible is that Joan of Arc's own brothers, Pierre and Jean, also seemed to believe that this young woman was their sister. The two brothers actually took this woman under their wing and started touring France with her as kind of a sideshow. The Chronicle of Orleans tells us that this Joan of Arc, back from the dead, even paid them a visit, where she was showered with gifts. And amazingly, we're told that at almost every stop, they met someone who had known Joan of Arc in life, and they were all convinced that this new lady was the very same Pucelle that they had met over 5 years before. But there are also a number of stories about this second Joan that seem a little suspicious. Apparently, during her travels, she made it all the way to the German town of Cologne, where she apparently did all sorts of weird magic tricks. And when I say magic tricks, I really mean magic tricks. These aren't like bringing baby back to life style miracles. We're told that her routine included tearing a cloth and then magically mending it, or breaking a glass of water and then magically repairing it, which sounds totally like a backyard birthday magician shtick to me. This Joan was known to drink wine and dance scandalously with men at taverns, promising to make them king just like she did for old Charles VII. But perhaps the most un-Joan thing that she did was get married. In November of 1436, only a few months after she appears in the historical record, she marries a retired knight named Robert d'Armois. Now, if you weren't already a little suspicious, the getting married thing should really tip you off. I mean, Joan's entire identity was deeply entwined with her virginity. The name that she went by was La Pucelle, which literally meant the virgin. Getting married is out of character, to say the least. Now, it seems as though Claude d'Armois' deception came to an end either in 1439 or 1440, when apparently Charles VII himself wanted to get a good look at this woman who was running around France claiming to be Joan of Arc. We're told by the chronicler Pierre de Sala that Charles decided to put Claude to the test. He welcomed this new Joan of Arc to his court and then asked her one simple question. He said, "Remember when we first met and we had that little meeting in my chambers and you told me a secret that only the two of us knew? What was it that you said that day?" Well, according to de Sala, the fake Joan broke down and confessed the whole deception right then and there, throwing herself at the mercy of the king. For most of us, that pretty much settles the issue. Claude d'Armois was a self-admitted fake who duped people for the fame, money, and gifts involved. However, there are still many who stay true to the belief that Claude was the real Joan. Those pushing this theory point out that de Sala's version of events doesn't really get corroborated by any other sources. And fair enough. They also point out that d'Armois doesn't seem to have been punished by the king, and continued to live comfortably as the wife of the knight for many years. It seems strange that the king wouldn't throw the book at this charlatan. This has led some to speculate that perhaps this moment with Charles never really happened. Perhaps she really was the real Joan of Arc. You see, it's just enough fertile earth to let a conspiracy grow. I mean, she did manage to convince the real Joan's brothers, or at least cut them in on whatever action she was getting from the scam. But for my part, I'm going to have to go with the wider academic consensus that Claude d'Armois was a fake. All the stories about her just make her sound like a huckster. I mean, magic tricks and cologne, come on. And on top of that, there are numerous witnesses at Joan's second posthumous trial who testify under oath that they watched Joan of Arc get burned at the stake, and they were confident that it was her up there. So, no, Joan of Arc did not survive her execution. In the world of Joan of Arc pseudo-histories, the Claude d'Armois was the real Joan of Arc thesis often gets folded in with another popular theory on Joan. This is the so-called royal bastard theory. Now, throughout this series, I have made no secret of how crazy I find the Joan of Arc story. I have marveled out loud more than once at how weird and unexpected it is that a peasant girl achieved all that she did in such a short time. Well, it turns out I'm not the only one who thinks it's kind of crazy. In fact, some people believe the story is so unlikely that they have forwarded a theory that Joan of Arc wasn't all that she seemed. Instead of being a divinely guided peasant from an obscure corner of the country, she was in fact a high-born lady who had been specifically groomed for her task as savior of France by her real birth parents. The theory goes that Joan was actually the illegitimate daughter of Isabeau of Bavaria and the Duke of Orleans. Now, as you might remember from the first episode in the series, Isabeau was crazy Charles VI's wife. Because of Charles' mental illness, Isabeau often needed to stand in his place and make important decisions about matters of state. Well, there was in fact a widespread rumor that Isabeau had been carrying on an illicit affair with the Duke of Orleans and may have given birth to an illegitimate child. Now, that might have happened, but here's where things get interesting. The theory is that Isabeau's illegitimate child was actually Joan of Arc, who she hid from the royal court by putting her in the care of some helpful peasants in Domremy. You may recognize this story as the plot of Star Wars. So in this version of events, Jacques d'Arc and his wife were Joan's Uncle Owen and Aunt Varun. Now, despite the fact that Joan was living with peasants, the theory goes that she was still educated as a noble. So she was not, in fact, illiterate, but instead we're told that she was fluent in a number of languages, including English. She was also secretly trained in the arts of war and strategy. This explains how she suddenly arrives on the scene at the Siege of Orleans as a capable military commander. This theory also seeks to explain why Joan was so quickly taken into the confidence of the Dauphin Charles. He may have been privy to this scheme and would have recognized the girl as his half-sister, perhaps after she gave him a secret sign upon meeting him. The hearing voices thing, that was just an act to get the gullible religious masses on board with this new audacious campaign against the English. Now, you can understand why this theory is attractive. It helps explain some of the more confusing and frankly unbelievable aspects of the Joan of Arc story. But this one has even less to it than the Claude d'Armois theory. First of all the dates don't line up. The Duke of Orleans dies on November 23rd of 1407. We know that Isabeau had a son with Charles on November 10th of that same year. So that then gives the Duke and the Queen a hot 13 days to conceive Joan of Arc before the Duke dies. And let me remind you that these would be the 13 days directly preceding the Queen giving birth to another child. So, yeah, super unlikely. But okay, let's suspend disbelief for a second and assume that they did manage to hook up in those 2 weeks. Isabeau became pregnant and gave birth to Joan 9 months later. That would mean that at the time of her death, Joan was actually 23 and not 19. That would have meant that she had misjudged her own age by a full 4 years. Now, back then, people did misjudge their ages. But a 4-year gap is pretty huge, especially when you're young. So this also kind of strains credulity. Then, on top of that, there's the fact that Isabeau had been one of the key figures in getting the Dauphin Charles disinherited in the first place. After the Battle of Agincourt, it was Isabeau who signed the treaty that made King Henry V the heir to the French throne after Charles VI died. She kind of screwed over the Dauphin by essentially stripping him of his birthright and handing it to the King of England. So it's simply not consistent that while she was signing treaties that basically gives France to England, she was also secretly training her illegitimate daughter in the countryside to be a religious warrior who could, I don't know, basically destroy the treaty that she just signed by getting the Dauphin crowned king? Guys, it just doesn't make sense. I just said that sentence out loud, and I could barely follow it. If she was secretly trying to help the Dauphin all along, then why sign the treaty? And your plan to help him is this weird long shot of training your own daughter to become a religiously guided super soldier? I mean, you would need to show me some pretty good documentary evidence to believe that. And, of course, there really isn't any. Instead, there's just scraps and speculation that occasionally get cobbled together in pulpy pseudo-histories with goofy names like 1961's Operation Shepherdess. Usually, the Royal Bastard theory and the Claude d'Armois theory get lumped together to create one grand pseudo-history of Joan of Arc. These theories get dusted off every few years and are repackaged in new books, much to the chagrin of most medievalists. But I totally understand their popularity. When the true story of Joan of Arc sounds so much like a myth, a well-constructed myth can sometimes feel more true. If If we reject the royal bastard theory, then we're still left with the same nagging question that has inspired this entire series. If she wasn't secretly a noblewoman who had been trained for her task from birth and cynically faked her voices to inspire her religious countrymen to follow her, then how do you explain Joan of Arc? Well, this is where modern psychological theories come into play. There have been many who have made the case that Joan's oddly overinflated sense of mission, the fact that she obstinately wanted to meet the Dauphin, and of course, the fact that she heard voices, all seems to suggest that she was suffering from a mental illness. The only question is, which one? Now, there are at least 10 different psychological and behavioral theories on Joan of Arc, so I'm just going to summarize some of the most compelling. The first and most commonly cited theory is that Joan of Arc was a schizophrenic. Those with schizophrenia suffer from delusional thinking. Often this manifests as the belief that they're being targeted by some larger-than-life conspiracy. But there are also cases when someone suffering from this illness can also have delusions of grandeur. That is, believing that you've been selected for an impossibly grandiose destiny. Well, that certainly fits with Joan of Arc. Schizophrenics can also experience both auditory and visual hallucinations. This seems like another obvious fit for Joan. But despite the fact that Joan demonstrates many of these symptoms, many Joan of Arc experts are not convinced that she was a schizophrenic. This is because of those trial records I was quoting from earlier. At her trial, Joan was lucid, intelligent, and able to pick up on the subtle traps being laid for her by her inquisitors. She has a clarity in her thinking and in her speech that is undeniable. In other words, she simply doesn't sound like someone who is suffering from schizophrenia. To label her a schizophrenic is essentially to ignore the most potent primary source on Joan. So most historians cannot accept that she had that particular mental illness. Another theory is that she was suffering from an inner ear condition. This could have either been tinnitus or Meniere's disease, both of which can create odd sounds in one's ears that often get mistaken for voices. Perhaps the noise created by these inner ear infections was interpreted by a hyper-religious young girl as the voices of angels. This is another interesting one, but it doesn't explain her visions of the saints, nor the clarity of the instructions that she was given by her voices, so that one's often also rejected. A third theory suggests that Joan wasn't suffering from a mental illness at all. Instead, she was tripping on a hallucinogenic substance. The culprit here was something known as ergot poisoning. This was a particular fungus that was known to grow on rye that can cause effects similar to an LSD experience. Ergot poisoning is currently a favorite theory to explain a number of strange medieval phenomenons, my personal favorite being the dancing plague of 1518. In that particular instance, over 100 people died in the city of Strasbourg after being overcome with an insatiable urge to dance. At the height of the so-called plague, nearly the entire town was out compulsively dancing in the town square. Some people even danced themselves to death. Some researchers now think that the entire town had been eating rye that had been tainted by ergot, and then they collectively tripped out. Now, this could have also been true for Joan. Perhaps she was exposed to some ergot and started having vivid hallucinations of saints. However, the trouble with this theory is that ergot poisoning eventually wears off, just like any hallucinogenic drug. And extended exposure creates symptoms that Joan simply did not demonstrate. I like this theory, but once again, it doesn't quite fit. Joan reported hearing voices for most of her life. One wacky piece of tainted bread doesn't quite explain an entire lifetime of auditory hallucinations. In 1986, researchers from Maudsley Hospital in London argued that Joan may have had a form of tuberculosis that led to a brain tumor. Brain tumors have been known to induce auditory and visual hallucinations as well, while also not producing the typically frazzled communication patterns of someone with schizophrenia. But later that same year, that theory was poo-pooed by one Dr. D.A. Moore, who thought that Jones' biography more closely showed symptoms of anorexia nervosa. He pointed out that she often suffered from poor health due to malnutrition and missed menstrual periods due to the same cause. She was also constantly fasting and ate very little. Her delusional thinking may have been part and parcel of dealing with anorexia at a time when that condition would have been completely unknown. Or perhaps Joan of Arc suffered from epilepsy. Indeed, epilepsy does not always result in seizures. Sometimes sufferers can see bright lights or experience auditory, visual, and even hallucinations of the nasal variety. I think everyone my age in Canada remembers the Heritage Minute with the epilepsy patient who smells burnt toast. The researchers pushing this theory wrote in their 1991 study, quote, "We suggest, based on her own words and the contemporary descriptions of observers, that the source of her visions and convictions was in part ecstatic epileptic auras, and that she joins the host of creative and religious thinkers suspected or known to have had epilepsy, from St. Paul and Muhammad to Dostoevsky, who have changed Western civilization." End quote. In their opinion, Joan was in a long line of religious luminaries who had also been epileptic, their religious revelations and their medical condition going completely hand in glove. I have to say, this one is somewhat compelling, but again, it only explains about half the story. Joan was never reported as having seizures, and it still doesn't explain the specificity of the information she was receiving. Lastly, the most recent theory on Joan of Arc that I could find was developed in 2004 by the psychologist Dr. Maggie Phillips. She believes that Joan of Arc's visions can be explained as a symptom of something called post-traumatic fragmentation. Now, this is a relatively new idea in the world of psychology that has been developed as we've learned more about post-traumatic stress disorder. There was once a time when the symptoms of this particular disorder would have been called multiple personality disorder, a pathology that was all the rage in the late 70s and also offered a predictable twist at the end of a number of cheap thrillers. Most psychologists now shy away from the theory that someone can have distinct personalities living inside their psyche. Instead, they understand the symptoms of this disorder as an elaborate coping mechanism that is sometimes developed by people who've suffered childhood abuse. Dr. Phillips argues that Joan may have been the victim of abuse as a young girl, and she may have been traumatized by events such as the Burgundian raids on her hometown of Domremy. Her visions of the saints may have been a delusion concocted to help her feel strong and safe in an otherwise dangerous and uncaring environment. After all, who's a better protector than the Archangel Michael? These delusions brought on by post-traumatic fragmentation could be ongoing and would seem terribly real. And unlike schizophrenia, they would still allow her to keep a certain clarity in her thinking. So, which of these best explains Joan of Arc? Well, here's the thing. None of these modern psychological theories offer a nice, precise fit for Joan. Whether Joan was an epileptic, had a brain tumor, or an inner ear problem, she's still a bit of a mystery. What I find fascinating is that none of her contemporaries, even the men who would put her on trial, ever seemed to think that she was mentally ill. And remember, this is a story that is filled with mental illness. The King of France, who had preceded the Dauphin Charles, was famous for his insanity, and the people at the time had no problem labeling it as such. If anything, you would imagine that the Dauphin Charles would have been especially wary of people with mental illness, because his own father was famously mad. Charles's legitimacy had been threatened because of mental illness. So it seems odd that he would so quickly embrace someone else with a mental illness as his totem and savior, especially a peasant girl. So this makes it hard to believe that she was crazy or suffering from any type of mental delusion. And indeed, most mainstream historians have been hesitant to embrace the modern psychological theories on Joan. Many of them find the theories reductive, or they fear that they're trying too hard to fit a medieval person into a modern frame of reference. We should also be careful not to jump to the conclusion that a mentally ill person could simply pass as normal during the Middle Ages. It's all too common for us to assume that every medieval person was hopelessly ignorant and superstitious. There can sometimes be this urge to say, well, of course she was crazy. Back then, people were so stupid that a crazy person could just say she was sent from God and everyone would believe her. But that's simply not the case. People knew from crazy. Charles VI? Yeah, he was crazy. Joan of Arc? Well, she was something else. She certainly wasn't normal, but explaining her life as simply the wacky fallout of an undiagnosed mental illness, it's deeply unsatisfying. So, how do you explain Joan of Arc? After the research I've done, I'm left with the picture of an incredibly intelligent and self-possessed young woman who was zealously devoted to her cause. In a way, she is the prototype of all teenage revolutionaries. You're never more devoted to your cause than when you're young. You're never more punk than when you're 17. I can't really explain Joan of Arc or her voices. All of the theories seem lacking to me. And even if one of them was correct, then there's really no way that it could ever be conclusively proven. One thing that I am sure of is that Joan of Arc wasn't a fake. Now, that doesn't mean that she was really talking to God. All it means is that I believe that she really believed that she was talking to God. Her sincerity is borne out in every word and in her every act. You don't lead the charge if you're a scammer. Charlatans don't take arrows in the shoulder and then come back asking for more. Even 600 years after her birth, Joan's convictions are still palpable. So the voices she heard could have been the result of a tumor, or childhood trauma, or bouts of epilepsy, or just maybe they were coming directly from the angels. It almost doesn't matter. To Joan, they were real. And they inspired her to shape the destiny of a nation. Okay, that's all for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. You can follow along on Twitter at ourfakehistory, or you can go to the Facebook page and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/ourfakehistory. You can also go to darkmyths.org. Dark Myths is the podcast collective that Our Fake History is a proud member of. And while you're checking out the shows at Dark Myths, think about checking out Blurry Photos. Blurry Photos is a paranormal podcast delivered with panache and a sense of humor. For those of you out there that like astonishing legends and just want more interesting paranormal stuff in your life, you might like Blurry Photos. So please go check out Blurry Photos at darkmyths.org. I also wanted to let you guys know that the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, has decided to put Our Fake History on the air once again. Yes, the show podcast playlist is going to be featuring the episode on Shakespeare. So for those of you living in Canada who want to hear yours truly coming through the old-fashioned radio machine, you can tune in to CBC Radio 1 at 11 p.m. on July the 7th, or you can catch it again on July the 9th at 2 p.m. That's on the show podcast playlist. So yeah, I'd like to give a big thank you to the people over at the CBC for putting the podcast out there again. And all of you guys that are the hardcore downloaders of the show, you can tell everyone that hears it on the radio, like, I knew that guy way back. So please tune in on July 7th or July 9th to hear that. Also, we are coming up to the end of this season of Our Fake History. So that means that at the end of July, we are going to be celebrating our 1 year anniversary. Oh my God, guys, we've been doing this show for one whole calendar year. And so for that occasion, I wanted to turn the show over to you, my wonderful listeners. So if you have any questions for me, anything you want me to discuss on the show, any insider information you've always wanted to know about our fake history, now's your chance to ask. You can email me, you can hit me up on Twitter, you can message me on Facebook with any question that you might have about fake history, past episodes I've done, myself, my production process, any old thing, my thoughts on music, my thoughts on, I don't know, everything. I'm an open book. So write me a question and it will be featured on the question show that will celebrate our 1 year anniversary at the end of July. So write in. I can't wait to hear from you guys. In the meantime, if you want to support the show, the best way to do it is to go to ourfakehistory.com and click on the donate to the podcast button. There you can throw a few dollars into the tip jar and help us keep the lights on here at Our Fake History. But if you want a completely free way to support the show, you can always go to iTunes or whatever other app that you use to get this podcast, and you can rate and review the show. Ratings and reviews help us get seen by other people, so please rate and review the show. As always, the theme music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com, and all the other music on the show you heard was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.